Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update for another week of analyzing the economic issues, trends, problems that we face as a nation. Everything about our jobs, our incomes, our taxes, the loans our student children have to take out, all of it. My name is Richard Wolff. I've been your host and I remain your host. I've been an economics professor all of my adult life in several universities in the United States, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns on a regular basis for truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis on a daily basis. Check them out at truthout.org. If you're interested in this program, in our analyses, please know that we maintain two websites where you can listen to all the back programs we've ever done. You can see interviews with me, lectures and classes that I give, links to information you will find useful. Please make use of them. They're available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and of course, at no charge. The first one is rdwolf.com. That's Wolf spelled with two F's. And the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of these websites contain all the information I just mentioned, but they also have two other capabilities that might interest you. You can use either of these websites to communicate with us here. That is, to send us comments, questions, criticisms of what these programs offer to you. It's a way for you to help us shape these programs and to have an ongoing interaction with what we are doing in this project. And the second thing you can do on either of the two websites is to follow us by clicking on the icon, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. So once again, rdwolf with two F's .com and democracyatwork.info. A final announcement before we jump into today's program. If any of the stations that make use of this program, and we are enormously proud that a growing number of stations around the United States are carrying us regularly and then some that carry us from time to time. If you would like to communicate with us, to discuss possible promotional collaboration with us, having me make announcements and so on, please get in touch with us very simply at Shane, S-H-A-N-E, at Democracy at Work. Very simple. Shane at Democracy at Work. Okay, let's turn to our economic updates. The statistics are now in for the first quarter of 2014, and the numbers tell us a story. There was virtually no growth, no real change in the production of goods and services. In order for our economy to serve the people of this country, it has to grow. The reason for that is our population, and hence our needs grow, and we have to grow with it, or else we have to spread what we produce over more and more people, leaving each one with that much less, assuming that was distributed equally. And I wanted to stress that there was no growth, because the last quarter was full of stories, radio, television, internet stories, using the word recovery. We're recovering, recovery, recovery. Yes, well, recovery is what you read about in the newspapers. When it comes to measuring the actual production of goods and services, there was no recovery. We were, in fact, falling back because we have a larger population having to cope with no increase in the output. The second remarkable piece of news comes from the World Bank and its International Comparison Program. And basically what this branch of the World Bank does is keep track of the total output of goods and services for each country in the world, trying to see how different countries are growing. Now, there's a lot of statistical problems with comparing countries that have different ways of measuring their output, different ways of counting what's going on, and then adding all that together to produce governmental statistics. But the World Bank has been doing this kind of comparison for a long time. And what they indicated was that the year 2014 will be very significant in one particular way. In 2014, the World Bank says, the total output of goods and services, often referred to as the gross domestic product, or GDP, the gross domestic product of China will surpass that of the United States. and that will be the case for the first time in the history of either country. The gross output of goods and services in China will be larger than that in the United States, signaling a change in how we need to think about the world economy and the role of different players in it. Kind of forces that on us if you think about it. The next short update that I want to bring to your attention has to do with a statement made on May 1st by the United States Treasury, and particularly by the spokesman for the Treasury, Adam Hodge. He's the official spokesman. Here's what the May 1st story said, that the United States lost $11.2 billion as the final tally on the cost of bailing out General Motors. Let me read to you the statement by Adam Hodge, one portion of it, of the Treasury, about that press release. Quote, "The goal of the Treasury's investment in GM was never to make a profit, but to help save the American auto industry." Let's discuss that for a brief moment. First, let's be real clear we all understand what these numbers tell us. Taxpayers in this country forked up $11.2 billion and handed it over to the board of directors and the major shareholders, because they're the ones who make all the decisions about what to do with this money, so they're the ones who got it, in order to save the company. Well, let's be clear. The company that was saved fired large numbers of people as part of this bailout. They weren't saved. The city of Detroit continued to decline because it wasn't bailed out, just the auto companies based there were. So bad was the neglect of Detroit that during the very time that this money was passed to General Motors to save it, Detroit marched to what it did in 2013, namely become the largest city in American history ever to declare bankruptcy. And finally, it allowed General Motors to discharge its medical obligations to its retired workers and to emerge as a profitable company whose stock would go up again and that can make money for those left to enjoy the benefits of an 11.2 bailout. Notice, please, that no conservatives are yelling about this. Here is the use of public money without any conversation about, gee, what else could $11.2 billion have done? How many people could have been helped in how many ways? To keep their jobs, to save their homes, to pay for their college education for their children, to buy goods and services that would have put other people to work. We don't discuss it. Oh, we worry a lot about helping minimum wage workers with an increase, but $11.2 billion for General Motors? Wow. The last thing. In European countries, when a government bails out a company with huge amounts of public taxpayer money, it demands something in return. For example, a part of the improvement of the company if the bailout helps the company to improve, shares in the company so that the public can participate in the rebuilt company its bailout alone made possible. But in the United States government of Bush and then of Obama demanded nothing in return. The government and we the people do not participate in whatever good fortune General Motors will have thanks to the bailout we provided. They get the gain, we absorb the loss. That's not right. That's not necessary. And it makes a mockery of any idea that this is a government or an economy that serves the interests of the majority of people. Let's continue with updates about recent economic developments. The United States Senate made some history in the last couple of weeks, debating and then basically defeating an increase in the minimum wage. The Republican members of the Senate conducted a filibuster and effectively killed the rise of a minimum wage, leaving the prospects for an increase in the minimum wage dimmed to zero, leaving millions of workers earning $7.25 an hour, which is the current minimum wage. So outrageous is this idea of a human being working a 40-hour week trying to support his or her family on $7.25 an hour. And remember, you don't get $7.25. From that is withheld your payroll taxes to support Social Security and Medicare. With that, from that maybe withheld income taxes. From that, you will have to pay sales and other taxes. The amount you actually get left for yourself is $2 or more less than that. We condemn millions of full-time, hardworking people to a standard of living that is really unspeakable. So unspeakable that several states in the United States have already moved to not do that. So, for example, Hawaii announced over the last few days that it is raising the minimum wage in that state to $10.10 an hour. Other states already over the $10 an hour level, California, Maryland, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C. Yes, I know Washington, D.C. is a city, but let's keep in mind that Washington, D.C., a city, has a larger population than Wyoming, a state. So this is an important part of our economy. California, Maryland, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C., now joined by Hawaii, recognizing the absurdity. And of course, if we wonder to ourselves, how in the world can we justify or even explain that the Congress of the United States, at least the Senate and for sure the House, oppose raising the minimum wage? That would cost some billions of dollars. And I just told you how quickly and uncontroversially $11.2 billion were handed over to the shareholders and board of directors, major shareholders. We're talking a group of 20 or 30 people here, got the $11.2 billion to bail out a corporation with nothing asked in return. But we can't raise the minimum wage. Well, the Demos Foundation, based in New York, has a lovely little graph to try to explain why the minimum wage vote failed in the Senate. And here's what they do. They compare the support for raising the minimum wage among the general public, what percentage of people answer a question I'm going to read to you in a minute, and then they measure the same response among wealthy Americans. Here's the question that the Demos Corporation polling asked. Should the minimum wage be high enough so that no family with a full-time worker falls below the official poverty line? That was the question asked. The general public, 80% of Americans support that. Among the wealthy in the United States, 40%, half of the 80% that support it are opposed to it. This is a Congress that depends on, listens to, and is politically in the pocket of the minority of wealthy who oppose raising the minimum wage as against the vast majority who support raising it. There is no way around understanding the meaning of that fact. Next update. A court in Europe, part of the European Union of Countries, the court that deals with problems, has rejected the opposition of Great Britain to establishing a Tobin tax. This is something that many of you have written to me about repeatedly to discuss and explain. So this gives me a chance in commenting on this European court report to do that kind of explanation. First, what is a Tobin tax? It's called a Tobin tax because it is named after a proposition made by Professor James Tobin, an economics professor at Yale, who, I might mention, was my teacher when I was getting my PhD in economics at Yale years ago. Tobin's idea was simple. We apply a sales tax to most Americans when they buy clothing and food and appliances and cars and so on. Why do we not apply an equivalently defined sales tax when people buy and sell stocks and bonds and various kinds of speculative securities to one another? In other words, why don't we apply a sales tax to the finance industry the way we apply it to other industries? Tobin, the economist at Yale, could find no adequate reason not to. In fact, he said applying a tax to financial transactions is long overdue, will raise needed money for the government, will require taxes to be paid by folks who should have been paying it all along, and might discourage some of the wild speculation in stocks and bonds if the speculators have a tax to pay every time they play one of their maneuvers. Britain has opposed it. They don't want to do it. And the British, very interestingly, use this kind of an argument. If we apply financial trade taxes here in England, then people buying and selling stocks will do it in stock markets elsewhere in the world, like in New York or in the mainland of the European common market, Berlin or Paris, Rome, or in the Far East, in Hong Kong and Beijing and so on. So the British don't want it, but the Europeans don't agree, partly because of the pressure from trade unions, radicals, socialists, and communists inside Europe. The French and German governments are in favor of this tax. This is their nod to the rage of the mass of people suffering through this crisis of the last 6 years and wanting the people they helped to bail out, the bankers, the stockbrokers, the rich in short, to pay some kind of tax to, as at least a partial payback for the enormous generosity of the taxpayer in bailing them all out. It would be too dangerous for French and German politicians to push against that overwhelmingly dominant popular opinion. So they support a very small tax on financial transactions. But the British want to have none of it. So the court ruled against the British. This is not the end of this struggle. The pressure to have a Tobin tax continues in Europe and elsewhere. There will be more court challenges. This plays on. But where is the United States? Where is the Obama administration in all of this? Do we as a nation support a Tobin tax? Answer, officially, not at all. The Obama administration, like the Bush administration before it, opposes imposing a Tobin tax. And here's their argument. Two arguments. One, we don't want to make the United States uncompetitive against Europe. Well, this is a peculiar argument. Since Europe is quickly marching, and since both France and Germany have more political and economic wealth and weight in Europe than Britain do, it's pretty clear that we're likely to get a Tobin tax in Europe. So the United States' argument, we don't want to disadvantage this country relative to Europe, because if we have a tax, people will go to Europe to do their transactions. This is no longer relevant because Europe is going to be taxing them. So that argument really doesn't apply. But the second argument is even weirder. If you apply a Tobin tax, said the Obama administration, you will make it vulnerable to evasion. What they mean is, if you apply such a tax, you create an incentive for people doing financial transactions to figure out 85,000 different ways to get around it, to avoid it, to hide these transactions, to relabel them. But stop. Do we avoid having laws against robbery because the robber will seek to evade punishment and detection? Do we avoid putting laws against murder because murderers will try to stop. Sure, there will be people who try to evade any law we pass. But that's no argument not to pass laws. At least no sane person would make that argument. And it suggests how desperate the Obama government must be, like the Bush government before it, to hide their subservience to the financial industry that just doesn't want to have to pay these taxes, to the wealthy stock hustlers who don't want to pay, to the wealthy who buy and sell stocks who don't want to pay. That has to be hidden, so you have to come up with these really weird, stretchy kinds of excuses in the hope that nobody pays attention. Let me turn from these shorter updates, as we often do, to some of the larger topics that deserve our attention. I want to begin by telling you about the implications of a recently announced decision by the Pfizer drug company, P-F-I-Z-E-R, one of the largest drug companies in the United States and indeed in the world. It announced a couple of weeks ago that it was going to buy a huge British drug company called AstraZeneca, a purchase worth $99 billion, making it one of the biggest mergers, corporate mergers, in history. And as a result, British shareholders will own more than 20% of the combined shares of the merged company. And under U.S. law, if 20% of your shares of a company are owned by people in another country, you can effectively move the headquarters, the legal basis of your company, from the United States to that other country. And Pfizer has announced its intention to do exactly that. Pfizer, a company born in a little warehouse in Brooklyn, New York, in 1850, roughly, is, and having been an American growth story in the 160-odd years since, is leaving the United States. I want to drive this home. Pfizer is abandoning the United States, and the reason is crystal clear, as countless commentators have made us aware. The tax on corporate profits that will be levied on the combined corporation in England is several points lower than what would have been paid if that company, an American company, had paid taxes in the United States, where it has been for the last 160 years. In other words, Britain just captured taxes that would and probably should have been paid to the United States, given that Pfizer has been a company here, has done most of its business here for a long time. There's a special law in the United States that allows companies that make profits from selling things abroad not to pay taxes until they bring those profits home. Pfizer, like many other large corporations, has decided not to bring it home, thereby postponing the taxes. Now, by buying the British company, they're no longer postponing the taxes. They'll never have to pay the United States these taxes. Taxes accumulated over the years, ever. A smaller bite of taxes will be given to Britain. This is a part of a process in which different countries compete for the capitalist monster corporations to go there. And this produces what everybody who pays attention to this knows about, namely a race to the bottom. Because understand what's going on. The corporations are smiling. They basically say to the British, the Irish, the Brazilians, the Americans, the French, the Luxembourg, whatever country, you want me to come to your country, have my headquarters there, pay workers in your country, please your constituents, make it worth my while. Give me a lower tax to pay. And then the company will leave one country and go to another. And a few years later, it will do the thing again. It will slowly drive down the total tax bill it has by playing one country off after another. So Britain got Pfizer to move from the United States to save 5% taxes lower than what they would have had to pay in the United States. Of course, that's worth billions to them. But What's to prevent them 2, 3, 4, 5 years later from playing the game again and moving on to Luxembourg, where the tax is still lower? And maybe while they've been moving to Britain and Luxembourg, the conservatives in the United States will get the tax rate down from the official 35% it is today to the effective, what they actually pay, which is in the neighborhood of 27%. Maybe we'll get it down to 20 or 15%, and we'll watch Pfizer come back. But it'll be a Pfizer that comes back having already saved all the taxes they should have paid in the United States for years, and now resuming in the United States with a tax bill much lower than what it was when they left, even though they've become a bigger company. In other words, corporations are now using the needs of countries to force them to bid against one another to give corporations less taxes to pay. Bottom line, all the competing countries, have less taxes coming in from corporations. So guess what? They all turn to their people and say, gee, we have less taxes coming in. Meaning, of course, even though they don't tell you that, less taxes from the corporations who are playing us against one another. And so the politicians say to the mass of people, you have a choice. You can either pony up extra taxes to make up for what the corporations have gotten away with in not paying, or we're going to have to cut services to everybody. School teachers, firefighters, police persons, and so on. That's the situation Europe and America find themselves in today. Local, state, national governments basically saying, we're either going to have to raise taxes, oh, nobody wants it, or we're going to have to cut services, oh, nobody wants it. The unspoken backstory, what lies behind this absurd choice, is something revealed by Pfizer. Corporations moving out of the United States, abandoning the countries where they got their start, abandoning the cities and towns and states that gave them subsidies and help along the way, abandoning all that to save some taxes and to force the United States to lower taxes even further on corporations than we already have in the last 30 years. It's a kind of polite blackmail, if you think about it. Final message. 50 companies have done what Pfizer has done. In the last 2 years, 25. Half of the total in the last 2 years. It's a race to the bottom for the mass of people. As countries compete, give up taxes, more is retained by the corporations, therefore the richer become the shareholders, the rich become richer, and the rest of us face either higher taxes or lower services, not because the economy is in trouble, but because of the kind of economy we have, which escapes taxes for the rich and piles on either taxes or service cuts for everybody else. It is an absurdity of modern politics to permit this kind of basic extortion or blackmail, whatever word you find comfortable, allowing corporations to run away with the game and leaving us all with a deteriorating economic system as our inheritance. No wonder these corporations are abandoning the United States. All right. Let's turn and begin our discussion before we take our, let's take our mid-program break. We'll return in a very short time. Please stay with us. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. I'll be back very shortly.
You're so cruel and shameless, but I can't leave you be. You're so cold and dangerous, can't leave you be. You got a kind of loving I need constantly. Hooked up to my motor all day long. We go down to Texas, up to Montreal. 2 hours no weather in the deep.
Welcome back, friends. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. And as usual, I want to remind you that if this program is of interest, if you'd like to pursue the kinds of material we've just spent a half an hour going over, then please visit either of our two fully available, costless websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to turn next to another story. Perhaps the word story isn't quite right, but it's something I want to deal with you about. This has to do with the economics of incarceration, the prison system in the United States. And I'm going to make use of an absolutely remarkable, comprehensive report. As best I can tell, this is the most recent, most up-to-date, and most thorough report on incarceration in general and on the economics of incarceration in particular. It was produced and released the last day of April, April 30th, by the National Research Council. 2 years in the making, a 464-page report. It was commissioned by the National Institute of Justice and the MacArthur Foundation, a foundation that supports this kind of research. So I want to talk to you about the economics of prison in the United States. First, for most of the history of the 20th century, from the earliest part of last century right up to the 1970s, our prison population was pretty constant. Even though our population was growing, the number of people in jail per 100,000, which is how these things are measured, stayed the same. It was about 100. 100 persons per 100,000 Americans were in jail, in prisons that maintained by the state and federal governments, and in the jails maintained by lower-level authorities. Then in the 1970s, the prison population of the United States took off. It's really important that we all think about this. So it was 100 people per 100,000 Americans from the beginning of the 20th century through the 1970s, for those 75 years. Then, between 1975 and today, it went up to, now hold your hats, between 700 and 800 people per 100,000. That's right. In the matter of the last quarter of the 20th century, we'll say that roughly the last 30 to 35 years, we have increased the relative number of people, the percentage of Americans, we hold in jail by 7 to 8 times. I mean, it's absolutely staggering. And not only is it absolutely staggering about the United States, that we have suddenly imprisoned a proportion of our people, unlike anything we've ever done in the recent history of this country. But we are unique in the world for doing it. I want to drive that point home, too. Today, nearly one in a, this is the report, nearly 1 in 100 adults in the United States is in a prison or jail. 1 out of 100. That rate is, I'm quoting now from the report, 5 to 10 times higher than in Western Europe and the world's other democracies. I'm going to give you some numbers. These are collected, and they are all printed in this report where you can find out all about this. The United States is listed as having, for the dates, I believe the date is either 2010 or 2011. I believe it's 2010, could be 2011. The United States, for every 100,000 people, has 707 inmates. Number two is the Russian Federation with 474. That's a bit over half of what the United States has. Number three, the Ukraine. Something to think about. 286. But now let me jump to some familiar countries and tell you what they have. Number of people in prison out of 100,000. Remember, in the United States, 707 out of 100,000. In Sweden, 67. United States, 707 per 100,000. In Sweden, 67. In Germany, 77. In France, 100. In the United States, 707 out of every 100,000. This is absolutely staggering that there should be such an outlandish difference in the behavior of the United States throwing huge portions of its people into jail in a way that no other country in the advanced, developed part of the world has done, or is planning to do, or has any intention of doing. This is kind of overwhelming. One of the implications of this, putting aside all the human and moral and ethical questions about doing this sort of thing, but one of the further parts of it is, what does this cost in the United States? And the cost is staggering. Let me give you an idea. Between 1980 and 2009, the cost of maintaining our prisons, housing those prisoners, guarding those prisoners, feeding those prisoners, building the prisons, maintaining the prisons, it rose 400% even after taking account of inflation. In other words, the costs of prisons rose four times faster than the cost of living. We are spending wild amounts of money on prisons and prisoners, which is not surprising when you consider that we put a disproportionate number of people in prison. And here are a few more statistics, because they tell you something about how prison is affecting life in the United States. Minorities constitute 60% of the U.S. prison population. Biggest groups, men under the age of 40, the poorly educated, people with mental illness, and drug and alcohol addicts are overrepresented. The incarceration rate, as has been remarkably documented and analyzed by Professor Michelle Alexander, but as this report shows, the incarceration rate for black people and Hispanics is much, much higher than for white people. Here's one result jumped out of the report at me. I will read it to you. Black men younger than 35 without a high school degree are now more likely to be imprisoned than they are likely to be employed. I'm going to read that to you again. Black men younger than 35 without a high school degree are now more likely in America to be imprisoned than employed in the labor market. I mean, part of me wants to stop talking about economics and plead with my listeners and my viewers to question any society about whom these kinds of statistics could be presented. A society that for most of its history didn't do this. A society that thinks it's got a financial problem, that it doesn't want the government to cost so much money, but the most rapidly rising cost of government is this absurd incarceration hysteria that no other advanced country has anything like. Is this not a time Are these not pieces of information to raise fundamental questions? You would think so. Millions of these prisoners and former prisoners, when we follow them after they come out, are either excluded from the right to vote and participate in society, therefore given yet another incentive not to concern themselves with civics and civic problems. We have an enormous recidivism problem, that is, people who come out of jails in these huge numbers being discriminated against in the job market, finding it harder to get a job, having to settle for a job that pays less, and all of that doing what? Pushing them towards behavior that will land them back in the prison system. This is a failed set of behaviors. But I want to talk to you about why. I want to talk to you about why did this happen? And I think the clue is the fact that suddenly we imprisoned huge numbers of people in the 1970s. So let me offer an economic explanation. The 1970s are a time in American history that I often talk about on this program because so much changed. Now we can see so much change in the world of prisons too. But what I usually emphasize is that the long period of time in which wages rose in the United States because people had jobs, because there was always a shortage of people relative to the jobs that a successful capitalism was able to generate. In the 1970s, that stopped. And remember, I've talked to you about that. Partly it stopped because we invented the computer and we replaced huge numbers of jobs with machines. I also explained and showed that the 1970s is when more and more companies do what we earlier saw Pfizer doing, namely abandon the United States, move production to other parts of the world where you can get away with paying people much less money, or you can get away with paying much lower taxes. For Pfizer, it was taxes. For the auto companies that abandoned Detroit, it was getting cheaper workers. That situation, the decline in jobs, explains why, since the 1970s, wages haven't even kept up with the cost of living, but rising wages out of the question. And we saw that one of the reactions of the American people in the 1970s to the end of the rising wage was the fact that they couldn't deliver on the promises they had made to their children, but also to themselves, to enjoy the American dream, to have a home, to have a car, to have a vacation, to send their kids to college. They couldn't pay for it with rising wages because the wages weren't rising anymore. So they went into debt. We all know that story. They borrowed on a home. They borrowed to buy the car. They borrowed on the new credit cards everybody could get. And they're now borrowing to put their kids through school. The debts are exploding. But now we see the other side of that story. There weren't enough jobs. That's why companies didn't have to pay rising wages anymore. People had to compete for jobs. They had to accept flat wages or even wage declines. If the average wage since the 1970s has not gone up, and that's the case, then for the half of the people who get below average wages, for millions of them, wages were going down. There weren't enough jobs for the people, and people had to compete to get the job. And the way they competed was by offering or being willing to work for less and less. It would have been much worse if all the people looking for jobs had continued to look for jobs. And there might have been real trouble if all the people who could have been looking for jobs had been looking, driving down the wages even more, making more and more people unemployed or paid so little that you would have had social trouble. Enter a new solution. Remove millions of young men from the labor force, particularly young men who might have been active, militant, willing to fight for a better job, willing to strengthen the backbone of a union. Remove them and stick them in jail. Get them out of the competition for jobs. and put them elsewhere. Neutralize them. Get them out of a society that is unable to solve its problems. Even as the society creates more and more incentives for illegal activity, because you can make more money that way than you can at the awful minimum wage jobs that this country offers people, $7.25 an hour, you're creating the incentive for any ambitious person to look elsewhere, especially if he has been discriminated against all his life, or hasn't had a chance to get an education, or hasn't had the money to do it, etc., etc. So what? We create an incentive, and then we imprison the people who pursue the incentive. We don't change the system, the jobs, the education, to deal with this problem in an honorable and humane way. No. We spend a fortune to incarcerate. Here's a little question that an irrational American would ask. Suppose we had spent the billions upon billions to build the prisons and to house the prisoners. If we had spent that money instead on jobs, on education, how many of those people might have been able to lead good, productive lives, rather than rotting in our jails, often abusively treated, at enormous expense to everybody else? A jail system that functions this way, that is completely unlike what any other civilized country does, is long overdue for fundamental criticism. And I really do urge those of you that have the time to go find this report, 464-page report from the National Research Council on the meteoric, costly, and unprecedented rise of incarceration in America. If your time is short, you can also read a wonderful article that summarizes much of what I have said today, written by Emily Badger, B-A-D-G-E-R, that appeared in the Washington Post newspaper on April 30th, 2014, the day that this report was released. In the final minutes of today's program, I do want to spend a few moments with you in responding to some of your questions. One of you, kind of cute, said to me, you know, isn't it the case that when you have a safer car, if you want a car that has all the latest safety stuff in it, don't you often have to pay more to get it? And the answer is unqualifiedly yes. And isn't it the case that if you want to buy food that has less damaging or dangerous chemicals in it or compounds in it, that you often have to pay more to get the food that is less harmful to your body? And the answer again is yes. And now the question that you sent to me is posed. Isn't that fundamentally unfair? Because we're basically saying those who have the money can be safer in what they drive and safer in what they eat than those who have less money, who can't afford the safer car and can't afford the more healthful food. And therefore, the market, which is the place where you decide what to buy based on what you can afford, that the market is an institution that enables, facilitates the unfair distribution of health and safety in a population. Well, I congratulate you who sent me that, since you didn't offer to allow me to use your name, which I require. If I'm going to mention it, I won't mention it on the air. And for those who want me to use your name, please let me know. I'd be glad to give you credit for the information and the questions you send me. But in this case, I want to congratulate you. You figured it out. Markets are a way of distributing goods and services. But most important is they're a way of distributing goods and services according to your ability to pay. So if you're rich, you get. And if you're poor, you don't. You know why? Because rich people want the things that are scarce. And the way they get them is by offering a higher and higher price until the rest of us who can't afford that drop out. We're no longer competing to get the goods that rich people have bid up in price. So if companies know that there are rich people out there who will pay X more dollars for a car with a safety device, good, they say. Put the safety device in there, charge the extra. As long as there are rich people to pay for it, we're not concerned that middle and lower income people can't afford it. Because in our system, we don't distribute goods and services according to need or according to some concept of fairness. We distribute goods by a market system. And the market system says the more you got to spend, the more you're going to get. And the less you've got to spend, the more inferior products you're going to have to live with or die from. That's a way of understanding markets that forces you to confront the other side of an institution that is uncritically celebrated by people afraid to look at and evaluate the other side. Last question that we'll have time for today. I'm going to read this one. When there's a massive movement toward the cooperative society you, Professor Wolf, envision, what do you think the ruling class will be doing? Do you really think they'll say, oh, well, you win, we give up? Well, I understand the point of this question. No, I don't expect the folks who sit at the pinnacle of our society, the corporate executives, the major shareholders, in short, the richest 1%. No, they're not going to go quietly. They're not going to accept a new society based on notions of fairness and inclusion and all the rest. They're going to oppose it. We know that. We can see that going on in the Congress every day. We can see it in the way our politicians serve them ahead of us. It's everywhere around us. And indeed, I talk about it on this program. But you know, the folks who sit at the top often tumble. They often do. Let me give you some examples. And here I'm going to quote from a company that has advertisements all over the subways of New York City right now. The advertisement reads in simple, bold black print on a white background, "The French aristocracy didn't see it coming either." It's something that makes New Yorkers stop and think. All of the people who ran societies in the past eventually tumbled. The societies broke apart. The societies collapsed. The inequality between a tiny group of rich at the top and the mass of people reached a point where the mass of people simply would not allow it to continue. Was that a violent moment in the history of countries? Yes, sometimes it was. At other times, it really wasn't. Let me take some examples from recent history. In late 1980s, 1989 in particular, the people in the Soviet Union basically decided they had enough. They didn't like the leadership at the time, neither Mr. Gorbachev nor the folks who came afterwards. They were dissatisfied with the way that society had evolved, particularly with inequalities within it, but other issues as well. And they basically withdrew their support. And that powerful government with nuclear weapons and the KGB and all the resources that governments have wasn't able to survive. It literally imploded, and by historical standards, very little violence. No one saw it coming. The Russian leadership didn't see what was happening. The American CIA caught flat-footed. It happens. And it happens when a society can't contain anymore its own contradictions, its own clashes within itself. It doesn't have to be a change that comes from the outside. In fact, it usually isn't. It's mostly the inability to survive. Will the folks at the top try to keep it going? Probably. But the issue isn't what they want, and the issue isn't what they seek. The real issue is, what will they be capable of? One of the best ways to end a war is when the soldiers are given an order to go out and fight and turn around and look at the officers who give the order and say to them, "You must be kidding. It's over." I think the changes in the United States that are building now are changes as people evaluate a society and reach the conclusion that they like this country, they like much of what they see a fantastic potential, but the actuality falls increasingly short of the potential, and that means change is on the agenda. And those who set themselves against change will discover in this country, as they have in others, that their refusal to make the change is actually what's building the size and strength of those who will insist on it. Thank you very much for your attention. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Well, they ain't gonna change. They ain't gonna change. Got the blues.